Mystery Club. Chapter 61. Chris Hudson is pulling his coat over his jacket as he leaves the station. He turns as a voice behind him calls out, "Sir." It is Donna De Freitas. She catches up with him. "Wherever you're going, I think I've got a change of plan for you," says Donna.
"I doubt it, PC De Freitas," says Chris. He still calls her PC De Freitas at work.
"I'm off to have a little chat with someone. Only, I was looking through the call logs," says Donna. "And I recognized the number. The mobile that called Tony Curran." Donna nods, then takes out a scrap of paper for Chris to see.
"Remember this? Jason Ritchie's number. He's the one who phoned Tony 3 times on the morning of the murder. Is this worth a change of plan?"
Chris holds up a finger to silence her and takes the piece of paper Terry Hallett had handed him from his jacket pocket. He passes it to Donna. "Vehicle records, from the day of the murder." Donna reads and then looks up at Chris.
"Jason Ritchie's car."
Chris nods. "Jason rings Tony Curran that morning. Jason's car is outside Tony's house when he dies. So we're going to see Jason.
Maybe just me this time," says Chris.
"I don't think so," says Donna.
"Firstly, I'm your shadow, which is a sacred bond of trust, etc. And secondly, I just solved the crime."
She waves Jason's phone number at him.
Chris waves the vehicle records at her.
"I solved it first, Donna. So I'm just going to pay him a quick visit at home, alone, and see if he wouldn't mind answering a couple of questions."
"Very low-key."
Donna nods.
"Good idea.
He's not at home, though, I checked already."
"Then where is he?"
"If you take me along, I'll show you," says Donna.
"And what if I ordered you to tell me where he was?" asks Chris.
"Well, you can try," says Donna.
"See where it gets you."
Chris shakes his head.
"Come on, then, you can drive."
Chapter 62. Neither Chris nor Donna had known that Maidstone had an ice rink. Why on earth did Maidstone have an ice rink? That had been a large part of the conversation on the drive there. This was after Donna had asked Chris to turn off his compilation of early Oasis B-sides. Bit by bit, Donna was intent on dragging Chris from his century into hers. The mystery had not been solved when they pulled up outside Ice Spectacular. How was anyone making money out of an ice rink, just off a ring road, sandwiched between a tile warehouse and a carpet ride? Chris would often tell friends that if there was a business in their neighborhood that didn't make any sense, which had no customers, then it was a front for a drugs business. Always. No real customers needed, no real profit needed, just a way of washing money. Every town had one, tucked away somewhere on a little row of shops, or in the railway arches, or sat next to a carpet ride. Whether it was a waxing parlor, or a party lights hire shop or an ice rink with a neon sign that last lit up in 2011. Always a front, always drugs, thought Chris as he closed the passenger door of his Focus. Which seemed apt, given who Chris and Donna were here to see. They walked through the front doors, across the sticky, carpeted foyer and into the arena. At this time of day it is mostly empty, except for an elderly man hoovering up popcorn from rows of plastic seats and 2 figures out on the ice. Anyone who had seen Jason Ritchie in his prime would tell you the same. He had a fluid strength, his feet simply gliding around the ring. Those powerful arms arcing through the air, or flicking forwards in rib-rattling jabs. His tiny feints and dips, eyes never leaving his opponent, his whole body ready to pounce and strike. He wasn't a slugger, a big plank of wood, a zombie. He was an athlete, strong and brave, a magnificent, flowing machine, everything given, nothing wasted. With his grace and his poise and his movement, Jason Ritchie was beautiful to watch. However, as Chris and Donna sip on coffees, watching, it becomes apparent that Jason Ritchie cannot ice dance. The session seems to be over,
As Jason is gingerly skating towards the side of the rink, his elbow being supported by a small woman in a purple leotard. Even so, about a meter from the sweet safety of the side, Jason's left skate disappears from underneath him, slices into his right skate, and his tumbling weight is too much for the lady in the leotard to save. The big man is down again. Chris and Donna have been watching for only a matter of minutes, but have already lost count of his falls. Chris leans over the board and offers a hand. It is the first time Jason clocks the two officers. He has been preoccupied. He looks Chris in the eye as he takes the proffered hand and finally reaches dry land. "Have you got 5 minutes, Jason?" asks Chris. "We've come ever such a long way. Are you okay, Jason?" asks the lady in the leotard. Jason nods and gestures for her to go on ahead. "Yeah, couple of mates. I'm going to stop for a chat. Well, look, I'm going to write this all up and send it to the producers," says the skater. "You're not a lost cause, I promise. Darling, you're a superstar, thanks for putting up with me and picking me up off my arse. Hopefully see you on the show," says the skater and waves as she disappears up the steep stairs on her narrow blades. Jason collapses onto a molded plastic chair, which bends a little under his weight. He starts to unlace his skates. "Thought I might see the two of you again. You got another photo for me?" "Well, shall we dive straight in?" starts Chris. "What were you doing at Tony Curran's house on the day he was murdered?" "None of your business," says Jason. He nearly has the first skate off, though it's a struggle. "But you agree you were there?" asks Donna. "Am I under arrest?" asks Jason. "Not yet," says Donna. "Then it's none of your business if I was or I wasn't." The first skate is finally off. Jason puffs like he's gone 3 rounds. "Just so you have the full picture," says Chris, pulling out his phone from his pocket and swiping it into life. "We'd been trying to find Ian Ventham's car on the traffic cameras near Tony Curran's house. A nice open and shut case. Ian Ventham didn't visit Tony Curran that afternoon, but we found something even more interesting. The first traffic camera catches your car, Jason, about 400 yards east of Tony's house at 3:26, and then the next camera, the other side of Tony's house, catches you at 3:38. So either you took 12 minutes to drive half a mile, or you stopped somewhere in between." Jason looks at Chris very calmly, then shrugs and starts on his right skate. "Okay, I've got one too," says Donna. "The day that Tony Curran was murdered, did you ring him?" "Don't remember, I'm afraid." Jason is picking at what seems to be an impossible knot in his laces. "You'd remember that though, Jason, wouldn't you?" asks Donna. "Ringing Tony Curran? One of the old gang, wasn't he?" "Never been in a gang," says Jason, finally making a breakthrough with the knot. Chris nods. "But here's our issue, Jason. A mystery number phones Tony Curran 3 times on the morning of his death. A number we couldn't trace, thanks to Vodafone and to data protection legislation. But a number that, thankfully, you had personally written down and handed to PC De Freitas. So your number, Jason." Jason finally has the second skate off. He nods. "That was silly of me. And then, that very afternoon, you are driving along the road outside Tony Curran's house, at which point you stop to perform some sort of errand, which takes around 10 minutes. At the exact time that Tony Curran was murdered." Chris looks at Jason for a response. "Yep. Sounds like you've got yourself a mystery there," says Jason. "Now I've got these skates off, I'm going to head back." Jason stands. Chris and Donna do too. "I wonder if you'd like to come in and give us some fingerprints and a bit of DNA," says Chris. "Just to eliminate you from our inquiries. We could eliminate you from 2 murders at once. That would be nice. You should probably ask yourself why you don't have my prints and DNA already," says Jason. "Maybe because I've never been arrested for anything. Never been caught, Jason, says Chris.
That's different.
Be interesting to hear a motive too, says Jason.
Robbery, says Chris.
Man like that has a lot of money lying around.
You got any money worries at the moment?
I think time's up here, don't you? Says Jason, starting to climb the stairs to the changing room.
Chris and Donna don't follow.
Or are you doing celebrity ice dance for the prestige, Jason? Asks Donna.
To which Jason turns and gives a genuine smile.
Then raises his middle finger, turns again and continues towards the dressing room.
Chris and Donna see him disappear, then sit back down on their plastic chairs and look out over the empty ice.
What do you make of that? Asks Chris.
If he did it, why on earth would he leave a photo with him in it by the body? Asks Donna.
Chris shakes his head.
Perhaps some people are just stupid.
He doesn't seem stupid, says Donna.
Agreed, agrees Chris.
Chapter 63. From outside, Elizabeth can immediately see that something is wrong. The curtains in Stephen's study are open.
They are always closed.
Stephen doesn't like the glare of the morning sun when he writes.
Her brain makes all of the necessary calculations in a second.
Has Stephen woken and broken his routine?
Is he hurt?
Lying on the floor?
Alive?
Dead?
Or has someone broken in?
Someone from her past life?
It does happen, even now.
She has heard of it happening.
Or perhaps someone from the messy present has paid her a visit.
Elizabeth circles to the fire door at the back of Larkin Court.
It is impossible to open from the outside without a piece of kit available only to the fire service.
Elizabeth opens it and slides inside.
Her feet make no sound on the carpeted hallway, but they would have made no sound on the concrete walkway of an East German detention center.
She takes out her keys and coats the Yale in lip balm.
It makes no noise when she inserts it in the lock and Elizabeth opens the door as quietly as she can.
Which is very quietly.
If there is someone in the flat, Elizabeth knows her time may be up.
Holding her key ring in the palm of her hand, she slides a different key through each of the gaps in her fist.
Stephen has not collapsed in the hallway, that is news at least.
His study door is open, morning sun streaming in.
She feels a momentary shame at the bright dust dancing in the doorway.
Checkmate, says a voice from the living room.
An Eastern European voice.
Well, I'm damned, replies Stephen.
Elizabeth slips her keys back into her bag and opens the living room door.
Stephen and Bogdan sit across the chessboard from each other.
They both smile to see her.
Elizabeth, look who it is, says Stephen, gesturing to Bogdan.
Bogdan has a moment of confusion.
Elizabeth.
He calls me that.
He gets things wrong.
To Stephen, it's Marina, dear, remember.
This doesn't feel wonderful, but needs must.
Like the man said, agrees Stephen.
Bogdan has risen from his chair and extends his hand towards Elizabeth.
I brought you flowers.
Your husband has put them somewhere.
I'm not sure where.
Stephen is examining the endgame on the chessboard.
The bugger got me, Elizabeth.
Fair and square.
Elizabeth looks at her husband, crouched over the board, backtracking moves, clearly delighted with the trap in which he has been caught.
Life in the old dog yet, then, thinks Elizabeth, and falls in love again for the thousandth time.
She repeats.
It's Marina, darling.
I call you Elizabeth.
Is okay, says Bogdan.
He fixed the light in my study too, dear, says Stephen.
We have a marvel on our hands.
That's very kind of you, Bogdan.
I'm sorry we're not as clean as we might be.
We don't get guests, so sometimes, Bogdan places his hand on Elizabeth's upper arm.
You have a beautiful home, Elizabeth, and a wonderful husband.
I wonder if I can speak to you.
Of course, Bogdan, says Elizabeth.
I can trust you, asks Bogdan, staring deep into Elizabeth's eyes.
You can trust me, says Elizabeth, her eyes never leaving his. Bogdan nods. He believes her. Can we go for a walk? You and I?
This evening.
This evening, asks Elizabeth. I have something to show you.
Is best to wait till dark.
Elizabeth studies Bogdan.
Something to show me?
Any clues?
Yes.
It is something you will be interested to see, says Bogdan.
Well, I'll be the judge of that, says Elizabeth.
And where will we be walking, Bogdan?
To the cemetery, says Bogdan.
The cemetery.
A slight shiver runs down Elizabeth's spine.
How wonderful the world can be at times.
I meet you here, says Bogdan.
And wear warm clothes, we be there for a while.
I think you can count me in, says Elizabeth.
Chapter 64.
Joyce, yes, I know Ian Ventham is dead, and we will get to that, I promise.
But guess what else?
Joanna is here.
We took ourselves down to Fairhaven in her new car, I will check the make in a moment.
We stopped at anything with a pulse.
I was very casual about it, but it was an unqualified success.
Not a word of complaint, or, no one's a vegan anymore, Mum, or, they do better brownies in a Lebanese shop round the corner from mine, Mum.
Green tea, flapjack, macaroon.
And I didn't think I'd be saying that.
She has a meeting down this way.
Something to do with optimization.
If I think back to that girl who would eat her fish fingers and potato waffles, but scream blue murder about eating her peas, I didn't imagine she would ever be having meetings about optimization.
Whatever it is.
The boyfriend is history, as we'd guessed.
Did you know you can lock your mobile phones these days, so that no one can take a peek?
And you can unlock them with your thumbprint?
Anyway, he had fallen asleep on the sofa one evening and she had used his thumb to open his phone.
One looked through his messages and, by the time he woke up, his suitcases were packed and in the hall.
That's my girl.
No details of the messages were forthcoming, but Joanna strongly hinted that photographs were involved.
I listened to enough Woman's Hour to get the gist of that.
Excuse my language, but the silly sod.
We had a giggle about it, so I don't think her heart is broken.
I can hear Joanna getting up from a nap, so I'll say bye for now.
You wouldn't know it, but I've been typing quietly.
My gorgeous baby, happy and sleeping in my bed, and two murders to solve.
Who could ask for more?
Joanna brought a bottle of wine down with her.
There is something special about it, but I'm afraid I've forgotten what it is.
One day she will realize that she is the something special.
Anyway, I invited Elizabeth over to have a drink with us this evening, but she has other plans.
Your guess is as good as mine there.
Something to do with the murder though, you can bet on that.
Additional note added later, IT is an Audi A4.
Chapter 65.
The path up the hill towards the Garden of Eternal Rest is a pale ribbon in the dusk light.
Bogdan offers his arm and Elizabeth takes it.
Stephen is not well, says Bogdan.
No, dear, he's not well.
You put something in his coffee, I think.
When we left.
We're all on pills for something, dear.
Bogdan nods, he understands.
They walk past the bench where Bernard Cottle spends most of his days.
Elizabeth has been thinking some more about Bernard, has had to in the circumstances.
She always gets the sensation that he is keeping guard for the cemetery.
That he's somehow at sentry duty on his bench.
He won't go in, but he's never far away.
What does Bernard lose if the development goes ahead?
She would have to speak to him at some point, or, perhaps better, ask Ron and Ibrahim to speak to him.
Which might mean tiptoeing around Joyce.
He hasn't played chess in a long time, Bogdan.
That was nice to see.
He is good.
He was a tough player for me.
They have reached the iron gates of the Garden of Eternal Rest.
Bogdan pushes one of them open and guides Elizabeth through into the cemetery.
You must be quite the player yourself.
Chess is easy,
says Bogdan, continuing the walk between the lines of graves and now flicking on a torch. Just always make the best move.
Well, I suppose, says Elizabeth. I've never quite thought about it like that.
But what if you don't know what the best move is?
Then you lose.
Bogdan leads her on for a few more paces before stopping by an old grave in the top corner.
You said I can trust you, okay, says Bogdan.
Implicitly, says Elizabeth.
Even though you are really called Elizabeth, because I see bills in the study.
Sorry, says Elizabeth.
But, other than that, implicitly.
Is okay, whatever you need to do.
But if I show you something, you don't tell the police, you don't tell no one.
You have my word.
Bogdan nods.
You sit while I dig.
It is a pleasant evening to sit on the steps of a statue of Jesus Christ, and Elizabeth watches very happily as Bogdan, over to her left, starts digging the grave in the faint torchlight. She wonders what he might have uncovered. What secret was he about to reveal? She goes through the possibilities in her head. The most obvious answer was money. There would be a suitcase, or a canvas sports bag, and Bogdan would heave it out and lay it at her feet. Banknotes, gold perhaps, a haul, buried by goodness knows who and goodness knows when. And a big haul too, or why has Bogdan dragged her up here in the middle of the night? Enough for someone to kill for? A couple of thousand and surely Bogdan would just have taken it?
Finders keepers, no harm done.
But, a suitcase full of fifties, well that would, okay, you come see, says Bogdan, standing in the grave, spade now over his shoulder. Elizabeth pushes herself up, walks over to the grave and sees what Bogdan saw the morning that Ian Ventham was murdered. She supposes that of all the things to find in a grave, a body should be the least surprising. But as Bogdan's torch plays over the bones and the coffin lid on which they rest, she has to admit this wasn't what she had been expecting.
You thought money, right, says Bogdan.
Maybe I found some money or something and didn't know what to do.
Elizabeth nods.
Money or something.
Bogdan is very good.
I know.
Sorry, no money.
Would have been good.
Instead, bones.
Bones inside the coffin.
Other bones, different bones, outside the coffin.
And you found these yesterday, Bogdan, asks Elizabeth.
Just when Ian was killed, yes.
I didn't know what to do.
I wanted a day to think.
Maybe it's nothing, do you think?
I'm afraid it's probably something, Bogdan, says Elizabeth.
Yes, maybe is something, agrees Bogdan glumly.
Elizabeth sits now and dangles her feet into the grave.
She looks down on the lid of the coffin.
So you opened the coffin.
I thought was best.
To check.
Quite right, agrees Elizabeth.
And you're sure it's a different body in there?
Bogdan jumps into the grave and pulls away part of the coffin lid, exposing the bones inside.
Yes.
Bones where bones should be.
Much older.
Elizabeth nods and thinks.
So, two bodies.
One where it belongs and another, much newer, where it doesn't belong.
Yes.
Maybe I should have told police, but I don't know.
You know how the police are.
I do know, Bogdan.
You did the right thing coming to me.
At some point we might need to talk to the police, but not yet, I think.
So what do we do?
Fill it back in, Bogdan, if you wouldn't mind.
Just for the time being.
Give me some thinking time.
I dig, I fill in, I dig, I fill in.
Whatever you need, until the job is done, Elizabeth.
We are birds of a feather, Bogdan, says Elizabeth, thinking she must call Austin.
He'll know what to do with all this.
She looks down towards the lights of the village.
Mostly off now, but Ibrahim's light is shining bright.
He'll be working away.
Good man.
She looks back at Bogdan, shoveling earth into the grave, covered in dirt and sweat. Sliding a broken coffin lid back over one body while carefully avoiding disturbing another body. She thinks this is absolutely the sort of son she would like to have had. Chapter 66. They are bang at it all the time, says Ron. Always have been. Whatever it is, the Catholic Church will have a piece of it. Even so, says Ibrahim. Ibrahim and Ron are discussing who might have murdered Ian Ventham. They are working their way through the list of 30 names, weighing up the possibilities. It is just the boys this evening. Joyce has Joanna staying and Elizabeth was nowhere to be found. Which, at this time of the evening, was suspicious, but they have chosen to carry on regardless. Ron is insisting on marking everyone out of 10, and the more whiskey he drinks, the higher his scores are climbing. Maureen from Larkin had just scored a 7, largely because she had once pushed in front of Ron at dinner, which spoke a thousand words. Father Mackey's our first 10, Ipsy, write it down. Top of the list. He'll have something buried up in one of the graves. Guaranteed, nailed on. Gold, or a body, or porn. All three, knowing that lot. He's worried they'll dig it up. Seems unlikely, Ron, says Ibrahim. Well, you know what Sherlock Holmes said, old son. If you don't know who did it, then, something or other. Indeed, wise words, says Ibrahim. And Father Mackey wouldn't just have dug it up himself, Ron. At some point? To save himself the worry. Lost his spade, I dunno. Mark my words though, says Ron, those very words beginning to slur gently and warmly. Late nights, whiskey, something to solve, this was the life. It's a 10 from me. This is not strictly cum poisoning, Ron. Ibrahim strongly disagrees with Ron's marking system, but writes 10 next to Father Mackey's name. As it happens, Ibrahim also strongly disagrees with the strictly cum dancing scoring system, believing it gives too much weight to the public vote when compared to the judges' scores. He once wrote a letter to this effect to the BBC and received a friendly, but non-committal, reply. He looks at the next name on the list. Bernard Cottle, Ron. What do we think there? Another of the big guns for me. The ice in Ron's whiskey chimes as he gestures with his glass. See how he was that morning. He has become increasingly agitated, I agree. And we know he sits up there a lot, on that bench, like he's marking his territory, says Ron. Used to sit there with his wife, didn't he? So that's where he gets his peace, in it. You can't take that away from a man, especially our age. Too much change don't sit right. Ibrahim nods, too much change, yes. There comes a time when progress is only for other people. For Ibrahim, one of the beauties of Cooper's Chase was that it was so alive. So full of ridiculous committees and ridiculous politics, so full of arguments, of fun, and of gossip. All the new arrivals, each one subtly shifting the dynamic. All the farewells too, reminding you that this was a place that could never stay the same. It was a community and, in Ibrahim's opinion, that was how human beings were designed to live. At Cooper's Chase, any time you wanted to be alone, you would simply close your front door, and any time you wanted to be with people, you would open it up again. If there was a better recipe for happiness than that, then Ibrahim was yet to hear it. But Bernard had lost his wife, and showed no signs of finding a way through his grief. And so he needed to sit on Fairhaven Pier, or on a bench on a hill, and nobody ever needed to ask why. Where is your place, Ron? Asks Ibrahim. Where do you find your peace? Ron purses his lips and chuckles. If you'd asked me a question like that a couple of years ago, I'd have laughed and left, wouldn't I? You would, agrees Ibrahim. I have successfully changed you. I think, starts Ron, face alert, eyes alive, I think, Ibrahim sees Ron's face relax as he decides to just let the truth come out, rather than think. Honestly? I'm flicking through it all in my head, all the things you're supposed to say. But, listen. It might be here in this chair, with my mate, drinking his whiskey, dark outside, with something to talk about. I bra him knots his hands together and lets Ron talk. Just think of everyone who isn't here, Ipsy. Every bugger who didn't make it. And here we are, a boy from Egypt and a boy from Kent, and we made it through it all, and then someone in Scotland made us this whiskey. That's something, isn't it? This is the place, isn't it, old son? This is the place. Ibrahim nods and agrees. His place of peace is actually the wall of files directly behind him, but he doesn't want to spoil the moment. Ron has stopped speaking, and Ibrahim can see he has gone somewhere very deep inside himself. Lost to memories. Ibrahim knows to keep quiet, to let Ron go where he needs to go. To think what he needs to think. Something Ibrahim has seen so many times over the years, with people in that very armchair. It is his favorite thing about his job. Seeing someone go deep inside themselves to access things they never knew were there. Ron tilts his head up, he is ready to talk again. Ibrahim leans forward, just a touch. Where has Ron just been? Do you think Bernard is banging Joyce, Ipsy? Says Ron. Ibrahim leans back, just a touch. I haven't really thought about it, Ron. Course you have, I know you have. Psychiatrist. I bet he is, lucky sod. All that cake and what have you. Could you still, you know, if you had to, he asks. No, not for a few years now. Same, same. A blessing in some ways. I was a slave to it. Anyway, I'd say he's a 9, wouldn't you? Old Bernard? He was there, you could see he doesn't want the place bulldozed, and he worked in science or something, didn't he? Petrochemicals, I think. There you are then, fentanyl. 9. Ibrahim is inclined to agree. Bernard does not seem to be living entirely in grace. He writes a 9 next to Bernard Cottle's name. Of course, if they are banging, Joyce won't like that 9, says Ron. Joyce has the same information that we have. She will already know he's a 9. She's no fool, that one, agrees Ron. What about that girl from the top of the hill? The farmer's girl with the computers. Karen Playfair, says Ibrahim. She was there, eh? Says Ron. Bang in the middle of it? Probably knows a thing or two about drugs. Pretty, too, and that's always trouble. Is it? Always, says Ron. To me, anyway. Motive, asks Ibrahim. Ron shrugs. Affair? Forget graveyards, it's usually an affair. A 7 perhaps, says Ibrahim. Or perhaps a 7 with an asterisk and a footnote explaining that the asterisk means in need of further investigation. Asterisk 7, agrees Ron, though with a pronunciation of the word asterisk very much his own. And that just leaves the 4 of us, eh? The only ones left on the list. Ibrahim looks down at the list and nods. Shall we? Asks Ron. You think there is a chance one of us did it? I didn't do it. That's for sure, says Ron. They can redevelop what they like, more the merrier, far as I'm concerned. And yet you led the objections at the public meeting, you lobbied the council and you started the barricade. All designed to stop the redevelopment. Of course, says Ron, as if his friend has lost his mind. No one takes liberties with me. And when else do you get the chance to cause a bit of trouble when you're nearly 80? But, mate, think of the service charge, the new facilities. Probably won't happen now. No way I'd have killed him, that'd be cutting off my nose. Score me a 4. Ibrahim shakes his head. You get a 7. You are very combative, you are hot-headed, often irrational, you were there at the heart of the scuffle and you are insulin dependent, so you know how to use a needle. That adds up. Ron nods, fair enough. All right, let's call me a six. Ibrahim taps his pen against his book seven times, before looking up. And your son, I think, perhaps knew Tony Curran a little. Which adds up to seven. Ron is no longer in his place of peace and his ice cubes now dance a different jig. He remains quiet, if not calm. Don't bring Jason into this, Ibrahim. You know better than that. Interesting, thinks Ibrahim, but says nothing. Are we scoring ourselves, Ron, or are we not scoring ourselves? Ron stares at his friend for a long while. We are, you're right. Well, if I'm a seven, then you're a seven too. That's fine, says Ibrahim and writes it in his book. Any reason? So many reasons, mate, Ron thinks. He is smiling now, the tension broken. Too smart by half, there's one. You might want to write these down. You're a psychopath, or sociopath, whichever one the bad one is. Terrible handwriting, that's a sure sign. You're an immigrant, and we've all read about them. There's some poor British psychiatrist, a white fella, sitting at home without a job because of you. Also, perhaps you're furious that your hair is thinning, people have killed over less. My hair isn't thinning, says Ibrahim. Ask Anthony about my hair. He admires it. You were there, right in the thick of it, as usual. And you're exactly the sort of person in a film who would commit the perfect murder just to see if he could get away with it. That is certainly true, agrees Ibrahim. Played by Omar Sharif, adds Ron. Ah, so we agree I have hair. Okay, I am a seven. Now, Joyce and Elizabeth. Ibrahim relishes the thought of talking late into the night. Once Ron goes, all there will be to do is read, to make more lists, then force himself to lie on his bed waiting for a sleep that always takes too long to come. Too many voices wanting his attention. Too many people still lost in the dark, asking for his help. Ibrahim knows he is usually the last person awake in Cooper's Chase, and tonight he is glad to have the excuse of company. Two old men, fighting against the night. Ibrahim opens his pad again and looks out of his window towards Joyce's flat. Darkness everywhere. The village is asleep. Of course, Elizabeth is too much of a professional to let her torch beam show on her walk back down the hill. Chapter 67. Jason Ritchie sits at a corner table, finishing his lunch. Monkfish and pancetta, both locally sourced. He doesn't know quite what to do. Jason is surprised by the changes in the Black Bridge. It is now a gastropub called Le Pont Noir, with its name written, black against gray, in minimalist lowercase font. Some of the rough edges have really been knocked off Fairhaven over the years, some of the darker corners have gone. You and me both, Jason thinks, as he sips his sparkling water. Jason is thinking about the photograph. He would feel a lot safer with a gun, and 20 years ago that would have been easy. He would have walked into the Black Bridge, talked to Mickey Lansdowne, who would have rung Jeff Goff and, before he'd finished his pint, a kid on a BMX would have delivered a brown parcel to the saloon bar and been given a packet of crisps and 20 BNH for his troubles. Simpler times. Now Mickey Lansdowne was in Wandsworth for arson, and for selling fake Viagra at car boot fairs. Jeff Goff had tried to buy Fairhaven Town FC, lost his money in a property crash, made another fortune selling stolen copper and had eventually been shot dead on a jet ski. And did kids even ride BMXs anymore? The photograph lies in front of Jason on the table. Taken in the Black Bridge long ago. In the days before pancetta and sourdough bread. The gang, just like it was yesterday. Laughing away like trouble wasn't round the next corner. Ever since he sat down, Jason has been trying to work out exactly where in the pub Tony Curran had shot that drug dealer down from London, trying his luck in sleepy Fairhaven. In about 2000, was it? It was hard because they had moved a wall, but he thinks perhaps it was by the reclaimed fireplace, with the locally sourced logs.
Coffee, sir.
The waitress. Jason orders a flat white. Jason remembers that the bullet had gone through the guy's stomach, straight through the paper-thin wall and out into the car park, where it went through the front wing of Turkish Giannis Cosworth RS-500. Johnny was gutted, you could see it, but it was Tony, so what could he do?
Turkish Johnny.
Jason has been thinking about him a lot. He is sure Johnny had taken the photograph which had been left by the body. Always had that camera with him. Did the police know? Had Johnny come back to town? Had Bobby Tanner come back? Was Jason next on their list? The boy Tony shot had died in the end. They had often come down from London in those days. Sometimes South London, sometimes North, gangs looking to expand, to find soft new markets. The waitress brings his flat white. With an almond biscotto. Jason still remembers the boy Tony had shot. He was only a kid. He'd offered a wrap of Coke to Steve Georgiou, in the oak on the seafront. Steve Georgiou was a Cypriot lad, used to hang around on the fringes of the gang, never liked to get involved, but was loyal. Owned a gym now. Steve Georgiou had set him up, told the young drug dealer to try his luck at the Black Bridge. Which the boy had done, before quickly realizing his luck was out. He was bleeding a lot, Jason remembers that, and it wasn't fun, he remembers that too. Thinking back, the kid must have been about 17, which seems young now, but didn't at the time. Someone put him in Bobby Tanner's old British Telecom van, and a cabbie Tony liked to use in this sort of situation drove him out to the Welcome to Fairhaven sign on the A2102 and dumped him there. That's where they found him the next morning. Too late for the boy, he was long dead, but he'd known the risks. The cabbie got shot too, because Tony thought you could never be too careful. That had been the end of things for Jason. The end of it for all of them, really. It was no longer young men making money, friends having fun, pretending to be Robin Hood, or whatever he had thought it was at the time. It was bullets and dead bodies and police and grieving parents. He'd been an idiot. He'd spotted it all too late. Bobby Tanner left soon after. His younger brother, Troy, had died on a boat in the Channel. Bringing drugs in? Jason never found out. Johnny did a run or two, straight after the cabbie was shot. And that was that. Just like that, with one bullet, those days were gone. And good riddance to them. They say two brothers from St. Leonard's now run things in Fairhaven. Good luck to them, thinks Jason. Still keeping it locally sourced. He walks over to the fireplace, then crouches. Yep, this was the place all right. He runs his finger across the reproduction antique tiles. Take them off, keep scraping and you'd find a little hole Mickey Lansdowne had filled in and painted over, 20-odd years ago. The one bullet that changed everything. There was nothing left here now, in the Black Bridge, with its memories and with its green tea with ginseng. All the gang gone. Tony Curran, Mickey Lansdowne, Jeff Goff. Where's that Cosworth with a hole, now? Rusting somewhere in a field? And where was Bobby Tanner? Where was Johnny? How could he find them before they found him? Jason sits back down and sips his flat white. Well, he supposes, he probably knows the answer to that. Has known it all along. Jason sighs, dips his biscotto into his flat white and calls his dad. Chapter 68. I got the photo on the Tuesday morning, says Jason Ritchie. Hand delivered, through the letter box. Father and son are drinking from bottles of beer on Ron's balcony. And you recognized it, asks Ron. Well, not the photo, I'd never seen the photo before. But I recognized what it was, where it was, all that, says Jason. And what was it? And where was it? And all that, asks his dad. Jason takes out the photograph and shows it to Ron. Here you are. It's Tony Curran, Bobby Tanner, and me. The three of us around the table in the Black Bridge, that's where we used to drink. Remember, I took you there once, when you came down. Ron nods and looks at the photo. In front of the little gang, the table is covered in cash. Thousands, 25 grand maybe, all in notes, just scattered about. And the boys all looking pleased about it. And where was the money from, asks Ron. That time? No idea, it was one evening out of many. But drugs, asks his dad. Drugs. Always, in those days, confirms Jason. That's where I put my money. To keep it safe. Ron nods and Jason holds out his palms, no defense. And the police have got the photo, asks Ron. Yep, they've got plenty more on me too. You know I've got to ask, Jason. Did you kill Tony Curran? Jason shakes his head. I didn't, Dad, and I'd tell you if I did, because you know there'd have been a good reason if I had. Ron nods. Can you prove you didn't do it? If I can find Bobby Tanner or Johnny, then I reckon. It's one of them. I can understand someone else leaving the photo by the body, you know, red herring for the cops to find. But why send it to me too? Unless Bobby or Johnny want me to know they did it. And you're not talking to the police. You know me. I thought I'd find them myself. And how's that going? Well, that's why I'm here, isn't it, Dad? Ron nods. I'll call Elizabeth. Chapter 69. Donna and Chris are in Fairhaven Police Station. Interview Sweet B. Not so long ago, Donna had been sitting in this interview room talking to someone pretending to be a nun. She now sat in front of a man pretending to be a priest. The parallel was not lost on her. Donna herself had made the breakthrough. Just a few background checks on Father Matthew Mackey. Run him through the computer, see what popped up. The background checks had taken a couple of days, because nothing at all had popped up. Which had made no sense at all. So Donna had spent a bit of time piecing it together, working out what was what, before taking the information to Chris. And now here they all were. At every step of the process, Mr. Mackey, Chris continues. At every step, you referred to yourself as father? You introduced yourself as father. Yes, agrees Matthew Mackey. Even now, you're wearing a dog collar, are we agreed? I am, yes. Mackey fingers the dog collar in confirmation. And the rest? The full kit, if you like. The vestments, yes. And yet, when we start looking into you, what do we find, do you think? Donna watches and learns. Chris is being gentle with the old man. She wonders if he will turn, given what they know. I think perhaps, possibly, there may have been a misapprehension. Chris sits back and lets Matthew Mackey talk. Which he does in fits and starts. For which I accept my share of the blame, and if you feel I have fallen short, I suppose, in some way, my intentions were not to mislead, but I see that that's how it might look, without all the, facts. The facts, Mr. Mackey, says Chris. Excellent. Let's get on to the facts. You are not Father Matthew Mackey, that's a fact. You do not work for the Catholic Church, or any church. That's another one. You are, and this has taken a full 15 minutes of research with the local NHS Trust, Dr. Michael Matthew Noel Mackey? Can we have that one as a fact too? Yes, admits Matthew Mackey. You retired from private practice as a GP 15 years ago. You live in a bungalow in Bexhill and, asking around there, you don't even attend Massachusetts. Matthew Mackey looks to the floor. All facts. Mackey nods without looking up. All facts. I wonder if you could remove the dog collar for me, Mr. Mackey. Mackey looks up, and directly at Chris. No, I'll keep it on if you don't mind. Unless I'm under arrest, which you haven't mentioned. Now Chris nods. He looks over at Donna, then turns back and drums his fingers on the table. Here we go, thinks Donna. It takes a lot to get Chris to drum his fingers on a table. A man has just died, Mr. Mackey, says Chris. And you and I watched it happen, didn't we? And do you know what I thought I saw? I thought I saw a man pushing a Catholic priest. A Catholic priest protecting a Catholic graveyard. And, as a police officer, that painted things in a certain light for me. You understand? Mackey nods. Donna is staying quiet. There is nothing she can think to add. She wonders if Chris would ever drum his fingers on a table at her. She hopes not. But what did I actually see? I actually saw a man pushing someone impersonating a priest, for reasons still known only to himself. Pushing a con man, which is what you are. A con man protecting a graveyard. I'm not a con man, says Matthew Mackey. Chris holds up a hand to stop him. Moments after scuffling with this con man, the first man drops down dead from a lethal injection. Which puts a different complexion on things, especially when we discover the con man is a doctor. But perhaps I've missed something. Mackey remains silent. I'm just going to ask you again, sir. I wonder if you could remove the dog collar for me. I am not presently a father, I grant you that, says Mackey with a long sigh. But I was, and for many years. And that confers privileges and this collar is one. If I choose to wear it, and if I still choose to call myself Father Mackey, then that is my business. Dr. Mackey, says Chris, this is a murder case. I need you to stop lying to me. PC De Freitas here has been through every record. The church has been very helpful. Whatever you've said to us, whatever you said to the council, to Ian Ventham, to the ladies who protected the gate, you are not a priest and you never were a priest. There is no record anywhere, no dusty ledger, no old photo. I have no idea why you are lying to us, but we have ourselves a dead body and we're looking for a murderer, so it's probably best that we find out quickly. If I'm missing something important, I need you to tell me. Mackey looks at Chris for a moment, thinking. Then shakes his head. Only if you arrest me, replies Mackey. Otherwise, I'd like to go home now. And no hard feelings, I know you are doing your job. Matthew Mackey crosses himself and stands. Chris stands too. I would stay, Dr. Mackey, if I were you. The moment you charge me, I promise I will, says Mackey. But, in the meantime, Donna stands and opens the interview room door for him and Matthew Mackey takes his leave. Chapter 70. It can be very hard to smoke in a sauna, but Jason Ritchie is giving it his best shot. Are you sure you're okay with this, Dad? He asks, sweat dripping from his brow. Just tell them everything, replies Ron. They'll know what to do. And you reckon they'll find them? Asks Jason. I should have thought so, says Ibrahim, stretched out on a lower bench. The sauna door opens and Elizabeth and Joyce enter, with towels wrapped around swimsuits. Jason puts out his cigarette in a pile of hot ash. Well, this is nice, says Joyce. Eucalyptus. Nice to see you, Jason, says Elizabeth, taking a seat opposite the half-naked boxer. I believe you think that we might be of use to you. I must say, I agree. That's it for pleasantries. Elizabeth fixes her eyes on Jason. So. Jason tells Elizabeth and Joyce the same story he told his dad. A copy of the photo is passed around the sauna. Ibrahim has had it laminated. I get the photo, confirms Jason, and I'm, like, what's this about? Where's this from? Is this the papers? Is this the front page of the Sun tomorrow? That's what I was thinking. But there's no message, nothing. There's no journalist on the phone, and they've got a number for me, so what's up? And what was up, asks Elizabeth. Well, I'm thinking, do I ring my PR? Maybe they've spoken to her. I was in shock, to be fair, this is 20-odd years ago, this photo, and a world I'd left behind. So I'm ready to deny whatever, or come up with something, stagdo, fancy dress, anything to explain it away. Oh, that's good, says Joyce. So there I am, still looking at his picture, and something clicks. I think, well, maybe this is the game. Maybe Tony's got hold of this photo, famous boxer, surrounded by cash, jailbirds everywhere. He sends me a copy, looking for a bit of money. Give me 20K, whatever, and I don't go to the papers. Fair enough, really, so I think, yeah, I should just ring him, have a little chat. See if we can work something out. Was Tony Curran the sort of man who might blackmail you? Asks Elizabeth. Tony's the sort of man who might do anything, yeah. So, first things first, I get hold of a new phone, cheap one, in town. Afterwards, will you tell me where, because I'm looking for one at the moment, says Ibrahim. Of course, Mr. Arif, says Jason. So, I ring him once, and no answer. I ring him again, same, leave it 20 minutes and try again. He's still not picking up. I never pick up if it's a number I don't recognize, says Joyce. I saw that on Rogue Traders. Very wise, Joyce, continues Jason. Then I came here for a quick drink with Pops and I saw the man himself, Curran, arguing with Ventham. Keeping all this quiet from me, says Ron, and Jason raises his hand to acknowledge it. So after me and Dad had a couple of beers, and me, says Joyce. And Joyce, agrees Jason. After that, I went for a little drive, just to do a bit of thinking. Then I headed down there, Tony's house, lovely place. Now, we're always cautious around each other, me and Tony, too many secrets, but I wouldn't be at his front door without a reason. His car's on the drive, so when there's no answer, I think he's seen me on his security and doesn't fancy a chat. And I didn't blame him, so I rang the bell a few more times and then I left. And this is the day he died, asks Joyce. The day he died. I couldn't hear anything from inside, so I don't know if that was before or after or whatever. Anyway, home I go and a couple of hours later I'm on this WhatsApp group, a WhatsApp group, asks Elizabeth. But Joyce waves her away and Jason continues. A few of the old faces, and someone says Tony's been found dead at home. I go cold, you know. I get sent the photo that morning and Tony dies that afternoon. Which leaves me worried. I mean, I can look after myself, but Tony could look after himself too, and see where that got him. So I'm nervous, that's natural, and then the police get wind that I've been to Tony's and they get records saying I'd rung Tony's phone that day too. And they've got a photo of me that was left by the body. You can't blame them, they think that stinks and so would I. But you didn't kill Tony Curran, asks Elizabeth. No, not me, says Jason. But you can see why the police think I did. Their case is compelling, agrees Ibrahim. And you're here to see if we can find your old friend for you, asks Elizabeth. Well, says Jason, the way my dad tells it, however good the police are, you lot are better. There are quiet nods all round. And it's old friends, says Jason. There's the lad who took the photo too. And who was that, asks Elizabeth. Turkish Johnny, the fourth member of our little gang. And he's Turkish, asks Joyce. No, says Jason. Ibrahim notes this down. He's Turkish Cypriot and scarpered back there years ago. I know some good operatives in Cyprus, says Elizabeth. Look, says Jason. You owe me nothing. Less than that. I've done nothing good here and Tony never did. But if Bobby or Johnny killed Tony, then they're still out there, and if they're still out there, then why not me next? Again, not your business, I know, but Dad thought it might be up your street, and I'm not going to turn down the help.
So, what do you reckon?
Ron asks.
Well, says Elizabeth. Here's my take. The others might disagree, though I suspect they won't. This is a mess of your own making. And a mess that came from greed and from drugs. And those are downsides for me. But there is an upside too. And that is that you are Ron's son. And I believe you are probably right, I believe we can find Bobby Tanner and Turkish Johnny for you. Probably quickly. And whatever you've done, and whatever we might think of that, I would like to catch a murderer. Before that murderer catches you.
Agreed, says Joyce.
Agreed, says Ibrahim.
Thank you, says Jason.
Thank you, adds Ron.
Not at all, says Elizabeth, standing.
Now, I will leave you to your sauna. I have to make a few calls.
Ron, I need to see you at the graveyard at 10 this evening, if you're free.
Joyce and Ibrahim, I'll need you there too.
Sounds lovely.
Wouldn't miss it, says Ron.
His son gives him a questioning look.
And Jason, says Elizabeth.
Yes, says Jason.
If this is a bluff, it's a high-risk one. Because we will catch this murderer. Even if it's you.